What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series.
Unconditional Love. The Leisure Hive by Simon Hart of Bracknell, UK. First story, Destiny of the Daleks. It was the trailer that did it. Swap Shop finished, and as I jumped down from the battered orange sofa to turn off the TV, a trailer began with the promise of new bizarre adventures for the Doctor, Romana and K-9. I can remember it vividly even now, the startling images it contained. A strange world filled with screens that were round like balls hanging from the ceiling, and the Doctor and Romana creeping around exploring. But most excitingly of all, a man whose head detached from his body while he was still talking. Those fantastic images immediately etched themselves into my mind. This was something I had to see. I talked about nothing else all day. How could these things all be happening? What was it all going to be about? Where was K-9? Suddenly, Doctor Who was coming back. This was just about the most exciting thing I could imagine. This one little trailer had captured my imagination and sent it spiralling. But that was nothing compared to the effect the story itself had on me. I think it's the strangeness of it all that got to me back in 1980. There was nothing else quite like The Leisure Hive on TV that I'd seen before. This story provided me with a gorgeously weird collection of images that embedded themselves in my head for years to come. K-9 exploding in the seawater on Brighton Beach, Pangle's head floating in the screen, the glimpses of the Famazi eyes, their claws ripping through fibre optic cables, and most of all, the Doctor screaming while being pulled apart for the cliffhanger of Part 1. I was scared and thrilled, and I couldn't wait to find out if the Doctor was still alive the following week. This was it. The moment where my liking for Doctor Who turned into love. I was obsessed, but in a good way. I'd found something that was mine. This was my story. As the Doctor likes to tell us, time marches on, and other stories came along that captured my imagination in different ways. There were stories that I absolutely adored. Stories that made me think, stories that excited me and took my imagination flying off in weird tangents. Gradually, I forgot just how important the Leisure Hive was in the formative stages of my becoming a Doctor Who fan. Other stories took on more importance as I met other fans. What was your first story, or which was your first target book? Those became the most significant ones. And for those interested, the answer to both is Destiny of the Daleks. But I'd never really thought about what it was that made me a fan. I just was. Then, one day in late 1990, I was given the opportunity to see any Doctor Who story I wanted. I was taking a tentative step into the world of pirate Doctor Who videos, and thanks to a contact via a friend at school, I suddenly had a long list to choose from, all available for a small price. My week's paper round wages ran to two stories, so what to choose? So much I'd never seen. So obviously, Sharda, as I thought I might never get the opportunity to see that again. But what else? Without thinking, I wrote The Leisure Hive. My friend was rather bemused by the choice, wondering why I'd chosen that one when there were so many classics to be seen. I could see his point of view. Why had I chosen The Leisure Hive? I explained that I wasn't sure why, I just had this urge to see it again. Eventually, my parcel of videos arrived. I put on The Leisure Hive and I remembered. I watched with rapt attention, transported all the way back to 1980, absolutely delighted that I'd chosen this story. As part one headed towards the cliffhanger, I sat forward in my seat and had a shiver down my spine as I knew what was about to happen. It had been etched in my mind almost shot for shot all those years. I just hadn't realised how far it had burrowed into my head. I don't really think I'll ever be quite able to adequately explain how much I love this story. So much has been written about it down the years, from the JNT effect on the show, through the style over substance argument, the subdued Tom, to how the Famazi couldn't possibly fit in those human bodies. But what none of those have ever mentioned is the effect that it had on one rather tall, shy, 5-year-old boy who sat watching this story in Weymouth in August and September 1980. Sometimes you can't adequately explain why you love something. You just do. That's me and the Leisure Hive.
Hi, I'm JR.
Hi, I'm Rob. And you're listening to You and Who Talking, where you've just heard from Simon Hart talking about the Leisure Hive and his experience with it over the years, originally watching it and then coming back to it later in life. And JR, I've got to say, this is something I can relate to. We say that so often on these podcasts.
Yeah.
But the nature of seeing something after a long time and how much of it is still in your mind is just crazy sometimes.
The bit where he talks about when he's rewatching it again for the first time in years, and he gets a little sort of shiver of anticipation as it's coming towards the first cliffhanger. That is something we can all recognise, that there. When the particular thing that hangs in your memory is about to happen and you know it's about to happen, that's a sort of fantastic feeling. And I guess it's about whether it lives up to your memory of it or not, or whether it sort of probably lands somewhere in between.
Yeah, throughout life I've had examples of all three of those instances. In fact, for the You and Who Else book, when I was talking about Into the Labyrinth, it turned out that my memories of it were good, maybe not so good though, and ultimately the show didn't deliver for me as an adult, so it can go both ways.
Oh, well, we were talking a little while ago about Death to the Daleks coming out on VHS, and I remember reading that book over and over and over again. And I had vague memories of it from it being on the television. Mm-hmm. And by this time, of course, Star Wars was out at the pictures. So I was imagining the planet Exelon as being something like the planet Tatooine.
Yes.
And of course, when the VHS came out, it so wasn't like the planet Tatooine.
Not at all.
But, you know, that's kind of a familiar thing that a lot of people will go to. And then what happens afterwards is that you learn to love it in spite of the ways it's let you down a bit.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned a Target novel there, and our next essay involves a Target novel as well.
From Miles Northcott, talking about the Mythmakers.
Mm.
Which is one of the more interesting Target novels, so this should be an interesting listen, hopefully, for people.
Yeah, absolutely. I have such fond memories of the Target novels in general. I mean, older Doctor Who fans are always going on about them. You know, the younger fans probably are sick of hearing us talk about them. But in some ways, for me in the 80s, it was the only way to experience shows from the 60s, for example, you know?
Yes.
I think of, say, The Celestial Toymaker. My opinion of The Celestial Toymaker is sky high because I experienced that first through a novel and probably read it several times, and it just doesn't compare. Well, we only have one episode of it, but aside from it is so much stronger in my mind through the novel than watching it on TV, I think, could have ever done for me.
Yeah, and Celestial Toymaker is another one where what's happening in your imagination is going to be so much more interesting than anything they could possibly have put on the television screen back in 1965, you know?
Yeah, on a very basic TV set, exactly what I mean, yeah.
Well, let's give Miles a listen and hear what he has to say about it then.
Absolutely.
The Mythmakers by Donald Cotton, by Miles Northcott. There are things in life that you can't do without. I'm not talking about the obvious things such as food, water and air, although quite clearly these are quite useful at times. I'm talking about things like music, love and humour. Unlike the aforementioned essentials, these three are things which can define a person, although I could name one or two people who could be defined by food. We all know someone who lives and breathes music, and as such, that becomes a fundamental part of who they are. Similarly, we all know someone who is so in love with someone or something that it is impossible to think of them without that concept in your head. Even if, or more likely, especially if, the person they love more than anyone or anything else in the world is themselves. Well, as far as I'm concerned, the thing that possibly defines me more than anything else is humour. And anyone who thinks it might still yet be food can go and do one. There are folks I know who might think that Doctor Who defines me, and in some ways they'd be right, as the show has dominated most of my life, and has, without doubt, been one of the things that has shaped me into the man I am today. Okay, stop it now, I know who you are, and you can stop banging on about food, dammit! When I were knee-high to a grasshopper, admittedly an 8-foot grasshopper, I started devouring... No, not my dinner. I won't warn you again. I started devouring the Target novels and stories like The Cave Monsters, The Dinosaur Invasion, The Green Death and The Loch Ness Monster. They made me think about environmental concerns, whilst the Doctor's policy of non-aggression, aside from the millions of deaths he's responsible for in several cases of genocide, struck a chord with me and made me a lover, not a fighter. Oh, not a lover of food. For pity's sake, I can hear you, you know. The moral code of the story is one that I follow. And so, yes, Doctor Who is a very big part of me. But humour is bigger. I always liked comedy shows. Hancock, The Two Ronnies, Morecambe and Wise. Some others do have them. Fawlty Towers, Monty Pythons. No, I do not want a wafer thin mint. Thank you very much. And many, many more. But in 1980, I discovered The Goons, and Peter Sellers became my second hero, behind Tom Baker, and was the first person outside of my family who reduced me to tears when he died in 1981. The madcap, zany antics of Sellers, Seacombe and Millican, and Benteen as well, although the ones he was in are mostly lost now, appealed to me at the deepest level. But what really resonated was how, despite being surreal and off the wall, they were clever too. Things like the classic Blue Bottle and Eccles, "What time is it?" sketch, where Eccles always knows the time because he has it written on a piece of paper, made me laugh and admire in equal quantities, and still now, after 35 years of knowing it, makes me chortle. I absorbed that goonery into my very being and became the school joker, never able to pass up an opportunity to try and raise a smile or, better yet, a belly laugh. Today, I'm the same, and my inability to resist going down the comedy route is... occasionally left me in deep water, so at times I've had to fight my natural instincts out of respect for good taste. No, not my natural instinct to eat. Are you obsessed or what? My favourite films include Airplane, Top Secret and Being There, Sellers' last and greatest work of and the best film ever made, in my opinion. There had always been humour in Doctor Who. It's an essential part of all good drama, to be able to balance the darker side of a piece or simply to amuse for the sake of it. Some of the Good Doctor's greatest tales are deliberately laced with comedy, particularly in the Patrick Troughton and Graham Williams eras, and whenever Tom Baker is let off the leash. And even the darker, harder-hitting stories contain some. Genesis of the Daleks, for example, has moments such as the tea comments when the Doctor and Harry are first captured, and the clam sequence. Legopolis, despite being almost funereal in tone, has the flushing out of the Master, and the measuring the TARDIS bits, etc. And it's well recognised by anyone who knows me that City of Death, one of the funniest of all Doctor Who stories, is my all-time favourite. Not because it mentions Weirbase, for crying out loud, you are so going to get a slap in a minute. Then, in 1985, well into the Target run, and with an already heaving bookshelf, I said bookshelf, not fridge. You can leave now, thank you. Sorry. Along came The Mythmakers by Donald Cotton. These were the days before DVDs and not long into the videotape era, and as such, all I knew of the story was from the various programme guides and the Radio Times Anniversary Special magazines. One thing I did know was that it was a pure historical, and by and large, those were predominantly towards the tail end of my preferred stories, and judging by which stories had been novelised at that date, towards the tail end of other people's preferred stories too. Aside from The Crusaders, one of the original trio of books, we'd only just at that time begun to get historicals. The Aztecs, the Highlanders and Marco Polo had been novelised, and whilst I loved the former, I was less keen on the other two. Oh, no, I didn't like Marco Polo because I thought it was about minty sweets, you numbskull. So, the only hint I had about the treasure that was about to rain down on me was that I knew of the episode titles, both the official ones and the ones Donald Cotton had wanted to use, which had greatly amused me when I first heard of them, but had no guarantee that the book would follow that format. I needn't have worried, however, as this novelisation was utterly brilliant and was devoured in one sitting. No, not like my dinner. Who let you read this in the first place, anyway, you cheeky git? Leaving me with a huge grin and a warm, tingly feeling of satisfaction. Oh, right, that's it. Stop it now. No, not like the one I get after every meal. I'm going to hunt you down like a dog and ram this podcast where the sun doesn't shine if you're not careful. I was, in fact, sorely tempted to pick it back up and reread it again straight away. Such was the delight I got from it. Not Turkish delight! Written mainly in the first person, from Homer's perspective, this was page after page of laugh-out-loud dialogue and description, and Cotton brought the various historical figures to life with gusto and made it easy to have an emotional response about everyone, even the minor characters. And the writing was both funny and clever, and I adored every page. I would say, indeed, that Cotton's comedic style fitted this story like a glove. A cotton glove, naturally. Despite other stories being better, in my opinion, and despite subsequent novelisations being brilliantly penned, this remains my favourite of the entire series, and one I always look forward to reading. After all, who couldn't adore a story with chapters entitled Small Profit, Quick Return, Zeus Ex Machina, and Doctor in the Horse? I heartily recommend this one to anyone. Okay, now that's done, I need to grab a sandwich. I'm starving.
Well, that comes as no surprise to anyone, does it? Hey everyone, Rob here. Look, Miles asked me to insert that ending there. I'm not being mean, and I certainly wasn't the person catcalling during that audio either. Thanks for that, Miles. Thanks again to Simon as well. But I do just want to jump in and give Miles the ending he wanted. And also just to mention, this is our 14th episode weekly of You and Who Talking. We're actually going to take a couple of weeks off for a well-earned break. We already have a number of essays lined up, though, for upcoming episodes, and we're always on the lookout for more. So if you have an essay, please keep sending them in, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with some really, really good essays. I hope you're looking forward to it as much as we are in presenting them. All right, now I better go because I'm really not meant to be here at all, as the second Doctor might say. So, quick, cue the music!
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.
Delight!